You're listening to Now I've Heard Everything, interviews from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s with voices from the past.
It really wasn't the goal of reaching the pole that we were seeking. It was the process of reaching the pole. It's the moment-by-moment experiences where you grow and you learn.
Explorer and environmentalist Will Steger, today on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson. Well, in this ever-shrinking world, it's getting increasingly difficult to be the first to do something. But back in 1986, Will Steger did it. He was the first to lead a dog sled expedition to the North Pole without resupply. That means nobody flying in extra food or blankets when things got rough. It was, in fact, an amazing and in some ways death-defying journey. After all, it's not easy when your face is frozen. You're only allowed a couple of pounds of food a day, and the environment only offers you a very narrow window of opportunity to reach your goal. Steger described all this in his 1987 book called North to the Pole. And that's when I had the chance to first meet him, in a nice warm studio in December of 1987. So here now, from 1987, Will Steger.
The book is about an unsupported dog sled expedition to the North Pole that took place in March of 1986. There's 8 people and 49 dogs. And we traveled for 55 days over the shifting ice of the Arctic Ocean to make the North Pole.
To someone who has obviously never been up there, I've never even been close to there. The only thing I've come across is the winters of the Midwest when I lived in Illinois. It doesn't sound that tough.
The big challenge is that we did this expedition without resupply. In other words, we did not accept outside support. In that way, it was a throwback to the expeditions at the turn of the century. We were self-reliant on ourselves and the dogs themselves. But we were traveling over some of the worst surface conditions on the earth. The Arctic Ocean consists of about 8 to 12 feet of ice that's constantly moving 8 miles a day. And there's these large plates of ice that come together and buckle up to form pressure ridges. And we literally had thousands of these pressure ridges that averaged about 30 feet high to cross. In addition, we had temperatures down to 75 below zero. We had very heavily loaded sleds, 5 sleds that weighed about 1,300 pounds each. And we had a definite deadline. There's only a 60-day window of time that this was possible. We couldn't leave earlier than March because of the polar night, which lasts 5.5 months. And then by May 1st, the ice would be shattered by the spring thaw. And that would be the end of the trip.
You don't just sit down and decide overnight to do something like this. It takes a lot of planning, doesn't it?
This expedition was 3 years in planning, which included a fundraising program in which we raised $750,000. And we trained 8 people, 50 dogs. We covered a distance of 10,000 miles in the Arctic in just the training alone.
Now, it's also something that you don't just take everything you don't figure out. I'd like to bring the little TV along and I'd like to bring this. You have to make a list of what you can bring and what you can't bring. How do you decide?
Well, the weight was the critical factor here. About 3,600 pounds of our original load was dog food, and about 1,200 pounds people food. But we had a way that calculate that out to the ounce. When we arrived at the North Pole on May 1st, we had about 2 pounds of food left. So you can get an idea there what type of calculation.
Keeps you fit and trim, I would imagine.
Yes. Well, and then again, it was by the thorough field testing that we had derived our rations and the types of equipment and the types of dogs that we used on this expedition.
There's so many parallels between what you've done and the people I just talked to yesterday, Dick Rutan, Gina Yeager. Here they're flying around the earth. They're spending only 9 days, of course, but they're up in the air. There's no possibility of anything. They measure everything very carefully by weight and be very careful about what you bring with you and what you don't. But it also strikes me there's another parallel. There were times when they began to hallucinate. There were times when they had doubts about their sanity. What are we doing up here? Did the same thing happen to you? Were there times along the route when you just said, my gosh, what are we doing?
Our biggest obstacles weren't the pressure ridges or the cold temperatures. It was fighting doubt. Most people said this expedition would be impossible. And we expected the worst, and we got the worst at the beginning of the trip. And we were looking at literally ridge after ridge as far as you could see. It would take us about 2 hours to to top these ridges. And it was always the challenge was keeping a positive attitude, keeping the spirits up, and fighting this doubt. The way we did this was to keep in the moment. We more or less approached each pressure ridge at a time without thinking too far in advance and getting discouraged about what we had taken on.
Do you hallucinate? Are there the equivalent of desert mirages?
Well, there are mirages because of the low sun conditions, where a mirage will look like ice walls in the distance. Sometimes there looks like islands floating in the sky, and this is an optical illusion. Now, towards the end of the trip, I was so exhausted. I had a hard time in the last 2 weeks of this expedition digesting the fat, and I literally couldn't eat for 2 weeks. And I was so exhausted at that point, I was literally hallucinating at the end of the day.
Is there a lot of fear associated with a trip like this?
No, I didn't. I really didn't experience fear. I had some concern for some of the other teammates being crushed by the sled. In fact, we did have two injuries on the way, in which two people were flown out. Bob McCuro from New Zealand broke several ribs when a sled tipped over on him. And Bob Mantell, the Arctic explorer from Alaska, froze both feet. And he was flown out on the fifth week. But I was concerned about paralyzing injuries, but I didn't view this trip as life-threatening.
Getting back to what we initially talked about, this was an unresupplied trip. It wouldn't have been quite the feat at all if you'd been stopping every so often and having a plane come in and bring you fresh food and fresh supplies and fresh dogs, as it were, and everything like that.
Yes, the resupplied expedition didn't appeal to me at all. There was, to me, no challenge, because when you're retired out or you're short on food, you'd fly in food or dry sleeping bags, and there was no real challenge. There you're just merely going to the pole. And it really wasn't the goal of reaching the pole that we were seeking. It was the process of reaching the pole. It's the moment by moment experiences where you grow and you learn. And reaching the pole on May 1st was actually fairly anticlimactic. First of all, there's nothing at the pole. It looked like anywhere else on the Arctic Ocean. But it signified to me the journey was now over. The 3-year journey was finished.
After this short break, Will Steger reveals what the North Pole actually looks like.
Start your day with Now I've Heard Everything.
We post new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time.
Subscribe now so you'll have something fresh to listen to and get your day going.
Now back to my 1987 interview with Will Steger.
How do you know when you're at the pole? It's not like the cartoon where there's a pole with a candy strap around it.
A number of people think there's a flagpole or the North Pole, or there's remnants from past expeditions. But you have to keep in mind that this ice is moving about at an average 8 miles a day. So if you're on the pole today, tomorrow at this time, you're 8 miles, 12 miles away. So the ice on the North Pole, the ice that's at the North Pole will take about 4 months before that's in the Greenland Sea. So there isn't a physical marker there to show you that you're...
Do you have to use a compass or something?
We use a sextant to measure the angle of the sun. And essentially what we did is, at the North Pole is the only area in the Northern Hemisphere where the sun cuts an equal disk all the way around the horizon for 24 hours. And you measure the angle from above the horizon at several different hours in variation. And then from there you derive that angle. You could also we could have used a satellite locator, where you push a button and you receive a little message that says you're now at this point, a little digital readout. But since we were self-sufficient and we decided to use just manual navigation, it depends solely on the sextant alone. The authorities, by the way, said we would be very lucky to get within 5 miles of the pole using manual navigation. And Paul Schurke, who was also my co-leader and co-author, got us within 100 yards of the pole.
It's kind of ironic in a way, though, that you can't plant a little flag or something there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is and it isn't. It's like that. The North Pole is like an invisible goal. It's arbitrary. You know, you can't define it when you're there. Well, you know, it looks like any other place that we've traveled through.
What happens to some of the things that you take with you? What happens to your skin? What happens to your food in those extreme temperatures?
Well, of course, everything freezes, and at the beginning of the trip, we had a lot of problems with frostbite. Everyone froze their face, and the face is mere cosmetic. It's not functional, but it's like a bad sunburn where the skin will peel off after a couple of weeks. The problem there is when the skin peels off, it exposes a real fresh pink layer, which it now refreezes again, is very painful. But you can put up with that on the face, but the real problems are freezing fingers and toes. In fact, Mantell froze several toes on the third day of the expedition, and his feet got worse and worse as he went on. A number of the dog drivers froze their fingers, and it was extremely painful. Working with the cameras and the sextant, too, was a very tedious job because of the cold temperatures.
Huh. What does it do to your food? I mean, is it just simply frozen food?
It's frozen, but we used white gas stoves in which we would melt the snow for water, and then we would boil up noodles or oatmeal, whatever the meal might be. So we would thaw the meal out with a stove, but it would take about 45 minutes in the morning in order to make water from snow.
And you probably have to be careful about what kind of foods you take with you.
Well, the foods were in a way specialized. It was very high in fat. Again, we were rationed to 2 pounds, 4 ounces of food per person a day, so we couldn't always eat all we wanted because of the weight requirements. Of that 2 pounds, 4 ounces, about a pound and a third of that was pure fat. Now why the fat? The fat keeps your body warm. The fat is like adding fuel to a stove. When it gets colder, you put more fuel, and the fuel that the body needs is high fat.
Did you ever get hungry for something along the way and you said, well, I can't wait till we get home so I can have fill in the blank?
Oh, yeah. Towards the end, we were on really tight rations, on the verge of starving. And at that point, you do think about food quite a bit. I thought a lot about a warm bed, electric blanket. In fact, the first thing I did when I got back to Minneapolis was purchase an electric blanket.
Could somebody from Florida have led an expedition as easily? I mean, from being from Minneapolis, did you have an advantage?
Well, I think my advantage was that I have had 25 years of experience in Arctic expeditions. It wasn't all of a sudden that I had this idea and went up and did it. I relied on, and part of the challenge lied in applying this 25 years of experience, where I had to put everything that I learned into this expedition. So in that sense, it was very specialized.
Must give you a good justification to laugh at people who complain about the 3 or 4 inches of snow that are on the ground.
Well, in the cities, if you're not dressed right, it can be very cold. I was in Chicago yesterday in that storm, and yeah, I was cold. I didn't have my long underwear on. But it all has to do with, attitude is very important, but and how you dress, how you eat when you're facing the cold.
Something, if somebody reads your book and they're inspired, they say, gee, that sounds like something I'd like to do. I think you would probably advise them to sit down and take at least the 3 years that you took to plan. So, again, it's not something that you go into lightly, is it?
No, but I think the North Pole is just an example of what we're capable of. You know, if people, especially young people, have a dream, and if you're persistent in following that dream, you can surely achieve that. And the North Pole is just an example. I don't think there will be many people that are going to form expeditions and do exactly what we have, but perhaps other people will be motivated to activate their spirit and go out and pursue what they want to do.
Now let me guess, a lot of people are saying, well, what's next for you now? Where are you going to go now?
Well, by sheer coincidence, I ran into a man by the name of Jean-Louis Etienne in the middle of the Arctic Ocean. He was the only person out there in an area the size of the United States. He was soloing to the North Pole. And I literally ran into this man. You know, I was dog sledding. I was paralleling a pressure ridge 31 days out. My dogs veered to the right, and I looked up, and here was this person in a blue parka. I walked up to him, and it was like the Stanley Livingston. I said, well, Jean-Louis, I imagine? And he said, yes. He said, are you Will? And we shook hands. That evening, we talked in the tent about our future plans, and we both had parallel dreams of crossing the Antarctic continent. So my next expedition will take place in August of 1989. It'll be a 5,000-mile traverse of the Antarctic continent, which will take about 7 months.
How do you get yourself psyched up for something like that?
Well, when you... I'm always psyched up for the Arctic. I mean, the Arctic and the polar regions draw me, and I always jump at the opportunity of going north, or in this case, going south. Although it's not that simple. In the Antarctic expedition, we have to raise $8 million first, and it takes about 2 years to prepare for an expedition and raise the money. So I travel 100,000 miles a year on jet planes just to raise money and do media tours.
Will Steger is 79 now. He's a popular public speaker and advocate for the preservation of the Arctic. Now, you can get a copy of North to the Pole by Will Steger by tapping on the link in our show notes or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. Now, we may earn an Amazon commission if we make a purchase. Heardeverything.com is where you'll also hear my interviews with two other explorers. My 1995 conversation with a man who knows the oceans better than anybody, Robert Ballard.
The ocean has such incredible moods. It can be beautiful and violent and moody, and it's actually very, it's the manifestation of what makes Earth so wonderful.
And my 1999 conversation with around the world balloonists Bertrand Piccard and Brian Jones.
We needed to be fairly fit before we went, not so much for the flight itself, but for the potential survival situations we may have found ourselves in.
But it was more of a psychological thrill than a physical thrill. We were always fighting against despair or too much hope. And that was really exhausting.
And of course, we post new episodes of Now I've Heard Everything here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything, a chilling interview I did a number of years ago with a survivor of the People's Temple in Jonestown, Guyana. That happened 45 years ago, November of 1978. So next time we'll revisit my 1998 interview with Deborah Layton.
Nobody joins a cult. You don't go into something thinking it's going to kill you. You join something, you go into a relationship even, and you can find yourself entrapped, imprisoned, that you don't know how to extricate yourself safely.
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson.